From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today on the program, after her son commits suicide, a Milwaukee mother hopes to raise awareness about depression. Then, why the Boys and Girls Clubs of America still matter.
I mean, not to sound all cheesy, but these kids are the future of where our nation is going. And if we're not paying attention to them, there's something wrong with us. We really do need to make sure that they're successful.
An exhibit showcases a creative response to a land in turmoil, Afghan war rugs.
What fascinates me is the fact that you've got this centuries-old tradition butting against contemporary reality and contemporary society and, in a way, very individualistic expression.
And a documentary follows one man's journey to meaning in India. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Depression affects nearly 1 in 10 Americans at some point in their lifetimes. The Centers for Disease Control report 5% of people suffer from major depression. But despite its prevalence, many experts say stigmas around depression continue, and it's one of the reasons why half of those suffering never seek help. That was true for Charles Kubley. The Milwaukee man suffered from depression for years in silence. He committed suicide at 28. Since his death, his mother, Billy, has worked to bring awareness to depression through a foundation in Charlie's name. That includes sponsoring tomorrow's second annual Depression Recognition Day at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Kubley joins me in studio with Dr. John Lerman, professor of psychiatry and behavioral medicine there. Billy, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Given that depression does affect a significant percentage of the population, why is it that we still need to bring awareness to this issue?
I think one of the key reasons is due to the stigma about mental illness. I think we're in a better place now than we've ever been before, but we still have a long ways to go.
Now, Billy, your family has had a firsthand experience with depression. Tell us about your son, Charles, and what he went through.
Well, Charlie was probably the last person you would think of that would have had depression. He was a very good student, many friends, and a great sense of humor, lots of fun. And it didn't come to being until he was 23. And he had graduated from college, living with us, and I saw a jar of St. John's wort in the kitchen. And it had just come out in the news that that could be good for depression. And I was shocked. Last person anybody would have expected, and he had covered for years. And he did say to me the year before he died, I wish I had done something in high school. And so then, of course, I said, well, we need to get help right away. So we immediately started him. So he was under psychiatric care for 5 years. The psychologist, he told me that the first question he asks when he has a new patient is, are you suicidal? And Charlie said, I think about it all the time, but I'm not going to do it because of my family. And then 6 weeks later, he died. So somewhere along the line, he gave up hope.
Dr. Lerman, is this something that you hear a lot, that people who are suffering from depression can cover for it, that even their family members don't often know they're suffering?
Yes, we do hear that. It is something that people can try to hide, again, oftentimes because they're embarrassed about it. They know something is wrong. They are afraid to share it with people, afraid of what people are going to think of them. Oftentimes another part of it is that they tend to isolate when they're depressed, which puts distance between them and their loved ones. So again, it's harder to know what's going on with that person when they're isolating more. I think oftentimes what may have exposed this to Charlie's family was the fact that he was living at home during this time, and they were really close, in close proximity, and a loving mom would realize that.
I want to add to what Dr. Lerman said. I think the stigma is also very great. And so he didn't want to share this with his friends. He was embarrassed, he said.
It seems like this effort to get rid of the stigma around depression has been
around for as long as you can remember. Why is it just so persistent and so strong and difficult to get people who are suffering to understand it's not something to be ashamed of?
Well, we tried to tell our son that it's a disease. You could have heart disease, liver disease, diabetes. It's the same thing, but it's just in your head. And ours is genetic, and that's what needs to happen, that people accept it as this disease. And of course, it is not a weakness. It's not an embarrassment. It's not their fault. Just like any other disease, it's not our fault. What boggles my mind over the stigma is that you accept physical diseases. The head isn't floating up above here someplace. We're all attached. And so I just don't understand why we have the stigma for depression. But it goes back. Wait, remember breast cancer or any type of cancer in the 40s and the 50s and it would be whispered about? That's where we are still.
I think Billy makes a good point. I think we're a product of our past. 60, 70 years ago, we had no effective treatments for depression and really didn't recognize it as the brain disease that it is today, that we understand it as today. And because we didn't, how did people deal with mental illness in 60, 70 years ago? We hid them upstairs. We sent them away to a place where they would live away from society. And I think that still is haunting us. I also think part of the nature of mental illness, a disease of the brain, is that it's so close to home. To even try to imagine this happening to us if we've never suffered from depression or a mental illness, it's unfathomable. And it almost hurts too much to even think about it. I can't imagine that going on with my brain. And so it's easier to keep at a distance and it's safer. So I think out of our own defense, we don't want to think about what having depression is. And then when you really struggle with it personally and have to face having this disease, the only thing that you have to equate it to is sadness. And we all have struggled with sadness. And we should be able to we're taught as children – well, you know, cheer up, you know, get in a better mood. But when you have the illness of major depression, it's not something you can turn around. You don't have control of it because it's a disease of your brain. It's not sadness. But that's the only thing we can really equate it to because that's the common experience that we all have. And what we're taught with sadness is that you can just snap out of it. But major depression is not something you can snap out of.
When Charlie came clean and told you about what he was going through, what did he describe he was feeling? What was he facing every day?
Well, I think there's pain with depression that they can't really describe, but it's also takes a physical toll on you too. And after he started taking his medicine, he was living with friends in the downtown area, so I didn't see him every day. And he was participating. He was very functioning. He had a great job. I wish you could see the scrapbook of all the laughter and the fun they had with him in the office. So he was very functioning. As I said, he had everything going for him. And people need to see that a person can be functioning, not the old idea of once in the over the cuckoo's nest and things like that. But the last year, he came back because his roommate had gotten married. But I knew in the morning if he was good or bad because I could tell how he was dressed. If he had his shirt tail hanging out and his tie untied, he'd go to work. But oftentimes, he couldn't maybe spend the whole day. But he had told only his boss that he had this. No one in the office knew. And his boss was very understanding and said, don't worry about it. When you can come, you can come. And so that's how we lived for 5 years. And I thought he was getting better, but didn't happen.
You talked about how we lacked effective treatment for depression for so long. Have we gotten much better, though?
We have become very effective at treating depression. It's not something that we can cure, okay? It's not a one-time treatment and you'll never have it again. But we are very effective at treating depression. But it does take a while. We need to be patient. It's not something that you give somebody a medication and the next day they're better. Our medications take 2 to 8 weeks to have their full effect. And that's assuming you've gotten to the correct dose. And that's each medication has about a 60 70% chance, 60 to 70% chance of being effective for the individual you're treating. That means there's a 30 to 40% chance that it won't be effective for the individual you're treating. And if they're one of the 30 to 40%, you're waiting 8 weeks to see if this medication's working before you start something else that's going to take 6 to 8 weeks. So it's an illness that takes time and we need to be patient with. Major depression is best treated with a combination of psychotherapy, talk therapy, and medication. The combination is better than each of the individual forms of therapy by themselves. Now, mild depression may be treated with just one or the other, but if it's a severe depression, it really should receive both modes of treatment. I also want to say that major depression causes more suffering in this world than cancer. They've done some studies to evaluate the amount of suffering that an illness causes and also the amount of cost to our society, the time off of work or people losing jobs because of illnesses. Major depression is a major cost to our society. I will also say that a treatment of the past that is extremely effective for depression, electroconvulsive therapy, is the most effective treatment, but because of the stigma, many people will not consider it. But it has about a 70 to 90% chance of efficacy in treating depression. Now, it is more invasive, so we tend to use it for the more severe cases or the treatment-resistant cases. There are new treatments that involve neuromodulation, including transcranial magnetic stimulation and deep brain stimulation that are being studied that are also being shown to have effectiveness in treating depression.
I wonder if that's the challenge in part in raising awareness about depression is that often those who are suffering from it may not be in a state to hear that you can get help, that there are effective treatments out there.
I would agree with that. If you're isolating and you have no energy, you don't enjoy things, you're not going to be social and going to want to share what's going on with you. Sometimes we're seeing some people that come forward afterwards, and I think that's one of the things that's making a difference with the stigma is that we're seeing people who are famous come forward and talk about their experiences with mental illness, and people can see that this is truly a disease and can affect all of us, and that helps.
I did tell him that if he called 10 of his friends together, half of them would have said that they had had a bout with depression. The evening he died, about 20 kids came over, and one by one they sought our family members to tell them that they had had depression, and even some had been in an institution for it. If you don't talk about it, you don't have a support system. So if he had mentioned it, he would have had five friends or more that would have all been there together, just like you have with breast cancer, with any disease. That's what's so sad about these people that suffer from depression. They can't open up, therefore nobody knows, and they don't have a support.
Is that why you're telling Charlie's story today?
Yes. I've got to get it out there. I don't want a family to go through this again. And I do think Charlie felt, well, everybody will be better off without me. His friends were devastated, and they were angry because he had not told them. I see these young people that it just breaks my heart. We've had quite a few suicides this last summer on the east side, Whitefish Bay and Shorewood and River Hills and Nicolet High School. And I just wish we could reach these kids. And most of them, nobody knew about them. That's what's the whole sad thing about it, even their parents.
So this Depression Recognition Day that will be happening at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Are you trying to reach those who are depressed, or are you trying to reach their families or their physicians? Who's the target audience here?
All of the above. We're going to have, in memory of Charlie, our second annual Depression Recognition Day. And at noon, we're going to have a talk by one of our scientists on transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a treatment for depression. During the day, we're going to have a table that will also be staffed with National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, along with my faculty members and trainees from the Medical College of Wisconsin, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine. And there will be information available for anybody who stops by. Also, we have a self-assessment for depression that somebody can just take themselves, and if they, even without even taking that, are in need of getting connected with treatment, we're available to connect them with the mental health professional. And then at 5 o'clock, we will have another talk on major depression or depressive disorders. That talk will also have, my understanding, there'll be a patient who struggled with depression at that talk who'll be sharing their experience.
Why is it so important to have that sharing of the personal experience?
We need to have people get out there that have had it and see that you can be normal. What is normal? I'm normal. I have depression, but I'm still normal. And I can lead a fine life and function and so forth. So we need to see more of that.
Dr. John Lerman and Billy Kubley, thank you both so much for coming in. And Billy, especially, thank you for telling us Charlie's story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I like telling this story, if it will help.
Billy Kubley is co-founder of the Charles E. Kubley Foundation, created in honor of her son, who suffered from depression and committed suicide. Dr. John Lerman is the Charles Kubley Chair in Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin, which is hosting its second annual Depression Recognition Day tomorrow. It features two lectures on depression and treatments, as well as offering other resources and self-rating tools. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a quick break now and then learn what the Boys and Girls Clubs of America offer kids in the Midwest. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. For more than 150 years, the organization that would become the Boys and Girls Clubs of America has been giving our country's children a safe place to learn, play, and grow. We have one of the largest and most active chapters here in Milwaukee, offering more than 200 programs to the city's children. It shouldn't come as a surprise, then, that the Boys and Girls Clubs of America's current president and CEO comes from the Milwaukee chapter, but there's another Milwaukeean who's made good on the national Boys and Girls Club scene. Erin Harang is now the Director of Events and Fundraising Midwest at Boys and Girls Clubs of America, and she joins me in studio to talk about what's new at the organization. Well, Erin Harang, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I want to start by asking, why do we still need Boys and Girls Clubs today?
Well, I will tell you why. So during the day in America, there will be between the hours of 3 and 7, so after school, it's when juvenile crime rises. Boys and Girls Clubs, which has been around for more than 100 years, is open at critical times for our kids. 15 million kids are home alone after school each day. So what are they doing with that time? And the answer for us is to come to the clubs, where we're doing academic programming, we're helping with art programs, we're doing leadership programs, and at the very base of it, we're a safe place for those kids to go.
Are you seeing changing issues in our communities that the Boys and Girls Clubs are responding to?
Well, I think poverty is also a very big issue, no matter where you are. In looking at the Midwest region, for example, 5 of the 10 most segregated cities lie within the Midwest. And we know that in Milwaukee specifically, that has a lot to do with the poverty levels and things like that. Part of our mission says that we're serving the kids who need us most, and that's where we are. We're in the central cities serving those kids.
You've worked at both the Milwaukee level and now at the national level in the Midwest division. What are you seeing that's happening in Milwaukee that is actually part of a bigger trend?
Sure. Well, I'm seeing Milwaukee actually is one of the best clubs in the nation. So I'm a little biased, but it's actually one of the largest as well. And they've got a lot of best practices. And then there's a reason that Jim Clark, who was president and CEO of Boys and Girls Clubs of Milwaukee, is now the president and CEO of Boys and Girls Clubs of America, is because he's got a great vision for where we're going. And so because of that, we're looking at something called the Great Futures Campaign. And through that, we're doing expanded academic support programs. We are increasing the membership and the daily attendance because we know that when kids come more, we can have more of an impact. And then we're doing high-yield activities. So in that time that we get them, we can make a high impact. And through that, we're hoping to get kids who are on track to graduate or for whatever success plan for what they want to do after graduating high school, that they're safe, which is always the base of what we want to do, and that they're engaged citizens and they're excited about giving back to their community.
What other issues are specific to the Midwest that you're seeing in the work you're doing?
I think locally and nationally, there's always the issue of how do we have high quality program and serve all the kids that need to be served. I think the clubs in most communities could open up their door to thousands of kids if they needed to. But then you kind of lose your quantity over quality. So I think the clubs right now do have a great balance and formula of saying, here's the measurement for how many kids that we can handle to make sure that if you walk into our doors and we're helping you read through our Spark Early Literacy program, that you're getting out of it what we intend to get out of it. And we know that that threshold loses its edge if we just open the door and become just a giant daycare center.
At its fundamental core, though, you do say that Boys and Girls Clubs provide a safe place for students. And I wonder if that's become even more imperative in the last several years as crime against young people has increased in communities like Milwaukee, particularly in Chicago, just to the south of us.
Mm-hmm. It's actually definitely been an issue, especially working from the national perspective and seeing more of the clubs have to deal with you specifically mentioned Chicago. They dealt with their part of their school system closing as well. And so then there's, kids on the street with that as well. And where do the parents take them? I would say one of the key issues that's been hard to deal with is that the mental health aspect. So, you talk about what are the keys to success and how do we learn and how do we engage those kids? And then they're in a neighborhood where there's crime, and maybe it's crime on a daily basis, and maybe it's normal. And actually, I know that in some of those neighborhoods, it is normal, and they deal with that all the time. And how do we overcome that? And I don't have the answer for that. That is a struggle. But how do we make sure that they know that if they feel threatened, that they can come to us, they can come to our adults, they can come to our volunteers, and be welcomed and be safe?
What are some of the programs that you've instituted on the national level that you've really seen success, targeted success, in our local communities?
Right. Well, actually, I'm going to flip that question because it started at Boys and Girls Clubs in Milwaukee, and it's actually going national because of its success. So this Spark Early Literacy Program is designed to help kids who are at a certain age range before they get too late, where it starts to become a struggle to teach them to read. It's almost like a remedial program, but it's not like Stephanie doesn't know how to read. Let's, everyone makes fun of her now. It's a cool club. So the kids love to come to it. It really engages them. It engages their parents, which is part of it, part of the success measure. And what it's doing is it's taking these kids and moving the needle and saying, okay, these kids would have been failing by this point, and now they're succeeding, and now they're reading. And we know that reading is at the base of every other success that they can have going through school.
That's awesome. Why has Milwaukee's Boys and Girls Club chapter been so successful in launching this program and, as you mentioned before, serving as a model for best practices? What's going on here?
Well, I have a couple answers, and they're going to be extremely biased coming from Milwaukee. One is I think Milwaukee is a pretty cool and generous town. I think we have innovative people here with innovative solutions. I was always amazed at Boys and Girls Clubs of Milwaukee by the creativity we had in the room when we knew that the outcomes for our kids' success was at stake. The other thing is, I think that we have a lot of businesses and business leaders that partner with us, that help us make these things a reality and allow us to try new programs and allow us to play with things a little bit. If we're allowed to measure and adjust and we have those resources available, it allows us to be able to expand and help us serve those kids better. Milwaukee's got a great business community when it comes to the nonprofit world and helping those kids, because we also want to live in a community where we have productive citizens, so it also benefits them as well.
Now, Erin, you had been in the nonprofit sector in Milwaukee for a little while before you went to Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee and now to Boys and Girls Clubs of America. What did you learn from your time here in Milwaukee that you've brought now to this new position?
You know, I've learned that people love to get involved, and sometimes it's really just asking them. And sometimes it's just figuring out what their passions are. So this is me asking Milwaukee to get involved. And I know so many people in Milwaukee are. Like I said, we're a very generous community. But I think it's for the kids, I think the hardest part is consistency. So making sure that when you are giving of your time, giving of your dollars, that it's consistently. I know some other social service organizations deal with this impact too, is that we want volunteers, but we also need them to commit for a long time. So you think of organization like Big Brothers Big Sisters as well, which has a one-on-one mentorship program, so important. But getting those volunteers to say, I want to do this for at least a year, is very difficult. So I would say that the generous people in Milwaukee are instrumental to making that happen, but it's just that consistency that we need to get up to.
What are going to be the priorities going forward for the national organization?
Well, we have that Great Futures program, and it's really about maximizing our programs and getting it to the kids who need us most so we can get those kids on track for success after graduation. And I think it's important to note that success after graduation is not going to a four-year college, which is one version of success. It's whatever that success means to them. So how can we give them the skills to do whatever they want to do? That's why we have a variety of targeted programming so they can kind of explore who it is that they want to be and what fits for them in their lifestyle.
Where do you see your role in helping these kids?
You know, I think about our mission a lot, and I think about these productive citizens that we're hoping to mold. And while I'm not frontline staff, I get to work with a lot of organizations and individuals that help us get the resources that make that happen. So I envision, you know, I get to work with club graduates and club alum that can shape how we're changing the future of this. I mean, not to sound all cheesy, but these kids are the future of where our nation is going. And if we're not paying attention to them, there's something wrong with us. We really do need to make sure that they're successful.
Well, Erin Harang, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Erin Harang is the Director of Events and Fundraising Midwest at Boys and Girls Clubs of America after working at the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Milwaukee. She's also the president of Women for MAC. Coming up, a new exhibit shows that even when war disrupts a culture, making art doesn't stop. We'll learn about Afghan war rugs next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Stephanie Lecce. Peace has been a fleeting concept for centuries in Afghanistan. The war the U.S. fought there came not long after the Soviet military occupation there. At the turn of the 20th century, it was the British that fought in Afghanistan in a series of conflicts in which they fought to defend what they saw as their interests in that Central Asian region. And even in the time in between, Afghanistan was not immune from war. But it was with the more recent wars in the background that the tradition of weaving war rugs emerged. The rugs depict everything from the occupiers themselves to maps to military equipment. An exhibit of Afghan war rugs is on display through early January at the Villa Terrace Decorative Arts Museum. It's curated by private collector Enrico Mascheloni and by independent curator Anna Marie Sawkins. They spoke recently with Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and Mascheloni talked about the rug's broader significance.
The first thing to say is war rugs are absolutely traditional in technique. So what's striking is the representation, of course, because they started before the Afghan wars, as everybody knows, that started with the Soviet occupation in 1979. And in the first phase of their short history, because the history is short, it's a recent typology, the weapons were in the border or in no central point of the rug. They look like to come in the rug just in a silence way. But during the wars, and especially in the beginning of the 80s, they became central and in some cases, and especially now, exclusive. They are just weapons in the war rugs. Anyway, what we have to do with this exhibition, the choice we did with Anne-Marie was to present for the first time the different typologies of war rug, because we consider war rug not only the rugs with weapons, with a prominent choice of, like a campionary of weapons. So we consider war rug also other representation, present something like a modernization of the traditional typologies. For instance, cityscape rug, and especially urban cityscape rugs.
So had Afghan rug makers in the past told stories in their rugs? This is just a modern manifestation of that?
They did. Yeah. The pictorial rugs start with, not in Afghanistan, but in Iran, with the attempt of modernization of the Qajari dynasty. They started at the end of 18th century until the First World War. They were striked from the European typologies that started to arrive also Persia, especially the French painting of 19th century. So there was something like a modernization, an attempt of modernization of the Central Asian rug with representation most of time with stories from the high Persian literature, like the Shahnameh from Ferdowsi, the Book of Kings, and the poetry of Nezami, things like this. For instance, the story of Majnun, Leila, and Love Tale, things like this.
So, Anna Marie, one of the things that makes all of these rugs so interesting is that they are predominantly made by women. Is that correct?
That is true, although I think increasingly there are also men involved in the process of weaving. But traditionally, it was always women that were weaving in the villages and among the nomadics.
So how did they get the information from outside? We always think of Afghan society, particularly tribal societies, being very closed, particularly for women, you know, that they don't see the outside world or aren't exposed to it very much. I mean, were people bringing in magazines, do you think?
In reality, I think it's a very visual culture, and that many Afghans are very keen observers. But there was also a lot of literature and images, postcards. I mean, Afghanistan has really been a center of trade and travel for centuries. It goes back to Genghis Khan and Alexander of Macedon or Alexander the Great. And so there's always been influences in the culture. And so using images from illustrations, postcards, propaganda, even U.S. propaganda, these all became source materials for rugs.
And Enrico, you were saying that the technique, however, is the same as it was centuries ago.
More or less the same.
So they're still hand weaving on a loom.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
And, yeah, the rugs are in fact knotted. You know, it's a knotting technique that's made on either a vertical or a horizontal loom.
And so are there different sizes of rugs in this collection that we're going to see here at the Villa Terrace?
Yes, they range from quite small, almost mat size, to larger. So I would say largely the medium and small size rugs. But there's one very large world map rug, which is just phenomenal, mm-hmm. and is presented in its own room.
Has its own space,
yes,
to take, yes, in. Yeah, I saw the representation of that, or the reproduction picture of that, and it looks fantastic.
Yeah. Oh. I think Bonn is very important to point out that normally, as you know, Ruhr rugs became famous even in Western country in the last years, not mm-hmm. before. But people think, also people who is involved with this carpet for dealing or just to study them, they think there is just one typology, the representation of weapons. It's not true. Mm-hmm. Because that one is just the one who is circulating in Western country. Mm-hmm. But as we told you before, there are the cityscape rug, mm-hmm. and many other rugs represent the attempt of representation of modernization. Because differently from people say, Afghanistan wasn't an isolated country. It was a country in the center of a big traffic, as Anne-Marie said, because it was central in the Silk Way, for instance, not only in ancient time, but also in the 19th century. Of course, it was a very strong country against any kind of people who try to come in, and especially for invaders. Right. They were the only one to gain a serious war against the British Empire.
Yeah, they won their independence quite early in the empire,
right.
You know, or the dissolution of the empire.
They
were, and I think somebody once said that Afghanistan was the place that, you know, nobody was really able to conquer. You know, they had their own ways of doing things, and they just weren't going to put up with it. Yeah.
One of the things that people will see in many of the rugs in the exhibition are some of the major monuments in Afghanistan, such as the Minaret of Jam, and also, in addition to world maps, also maps of Afghanistan. And then major monuments like dams or bridges and cityscapes, as mentioned earlier, that might be either Western or even from North America.
How did this collection come to be? This is a group of private collectors that this all comes from?
Most of the rugs were bought in Central Asia, especially during the 80s and also the beginning of the 90s, when Kabul and the main Afghan cities were very difficult to visit. Because before the Soviet occupation and after the fight of Mujahideen groups, immediately after the emirate of Taliban until 2001, so the main bazaar to find important war rugs was Peshawar in Pakistan. It's a borderline city. Now maybe it's more dangerous than Afghanistan, but at the time more or less it was possible to go there without big problems. And in the 80s was the main market. So most of the rugs come from Peshawar. But also other come from Herat, from Kabul, and even someone has been bought in Europe.
Okay, so they've traveled as far as Europe.
As you know very well, Afghanistan in the 60s and 70s was the center point of the hippie trek to Asia. So the modernization of the country, and especially the cityscape rug, this is my opinion, I haven't a sure proof, but probably come from the considering the interest also from local dealer for this strange tourist.
Are these rugs still being made, or were these of a particular time and they are moving on to other kinds of expression in rug making?
No, they're still being made. Obviously, there's been some shifts in production area, with rugs originally being made in Afghanistan and now often in refugee camps in Pakistan. And of course, the art is evolving at the same time, too.
In what way? How is it changing?
Well, it is a craft that's influenced by the market. So when there's interest in a certain type of rug, then the dealers will find more of that type of rug. So the weavers are responding to what's selling in the marketplace.
So is that a representation of a modernization of Afghanistan? Is that what makes these rugs important artistically?
Well, it's interesting because I think originally or initially, it wasn't so much the dealers that were interested in these rugs. It was rather curators and contemporary art curators like Enrico, primarily because they were different and they represented a very sort of real and new expression. And of course, what fascinates me is the fact that you've got this centuries-old tradition butting against contemporary reality and contemporary society and really, in a way, very individualistic expression. So they're very refreshing. The dealers tended to concentrate more on the antique rugs and sort of high quality, high knot numbers and this and that, and overlooking sort of the freshness of this imagery.
I want to thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you to you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Enrico Mascheloni and Anna Marie Sawkins are curators of the exhibit Afghan War Rugs, the Modern Art of Central Asia, on display through early January at the Villa Terrace Decorative Arts Museum. They spoke with Bonnie North, and you can see what some of the rugs look like at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. From the streets of Pittsburgh to helping orphans with AIDS in India, a documentary follows one man's journey to finding his calling. We speak with the director of Blood Brother when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. There are a lot of movies out there about protagonists trying to find themselves in exotic locations like India. Think Eat, Pray, Love. But in the case of the film Blood Brother, it's a true story. Pittsburgh native Rocky Brott was sick of his life stateside when he went to India in search of something meaningful, and he found his calling in an unexpected place. Or maybe it found him. Brott's story was documented on film by friend and director Steve Hoover. He tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about one of the reasons Rocky chose to go to India.
He had seen a documentary on Mother Teresa years ago, and he said he was always impacted by just kind of the way he saw her taking care of people. And he felt like he wanted to have an experience like that as well, and that he wouldn't be able to find that, an authentic experience like that in the U.S., you know, where people were, I guess, that poor, and that we have so many systems set up for people who are suffering, or that they typically don't get to that place, you know, where they're lying on the street and maggots are eating their body. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons why I think Rocky went. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure why Westerners go to places like India for, I guess, you know, spiritual experiences or different types of enlightenment. I think it has that. It just has a reputation, and I think people get bored or complacent with living the lives that we live, very scheduled, predictable lives for the most part. And India just seems so out of the ordinary, and again, kind of has that reputation for giving people something that it attracts those types of people, I guess.
There are certainly Americans that go there and do volunteer work and experience similar experiences to Rocky's. And what I find interesting is that he set out to go on a spiritual journey. And unlike a lot of us who travel, and some people go to India and go on yoga retreats, or they do other kinds of things that some would not consider really spiritual, but he actually found it. He found something really meaningful there.
You know, it's interesting because I think he was, you know, when he first connected with the orphanage, he actually hated it. His first week there, he went, he met the kids, and he just hated India as a whole. It was, you know, it was hot. He was in southern India. It was uncomfortable. He was eating food and getting rocks in it, getting tore up by mosquitoes. There's a lot of different things that he just did not like about it. And so he and the guy that he was with, they were like, decided to leave. They booked flights to Australia. They were like, let's go hang out on the beach for the rest of the summer instead of here. And they were actually on the train on their way to the airport, and he said he just felt like something kind of came over him, and he had to go back. So they canceled their flights, lost money, and went back to the orphanage, and they ended up being there for just about the rest of the summer until he went on the trip to northern India that he talks about in the film. So there were sort of these two moments of leaving the orphanage and coming back. But the first one, I think it might have been a little more dramatic in that he just didn't like India. So I think it was a surprise to him. It definitely was a surprise to me when he came back and did find something there. And I think it was a surprise to him as well, because in some ways he tried to, I guess, run away from it or leave it.
What compelled you to go then, after hearing all these stories about how much he hated it?
Initially he hated it.
Okay.
But when he came back, after his spending the summer there, he had, you know, developed relationships with these people that, you know, he couldn't really abandon or shake. So when he came back, he kind of, there was something about him, like you could tell that he was changed or that something was different. And he had committed to basically saving up for a year and moving to India after that summer. It's still at that point, I wasn't interested in going. And I didn't really understand what it was about the kids or his experience that had moved him. And he was, like, him and I shared a room, not just an apartment. We shared a room because we lived with a handful of people. And, I mean, he put calendars and photos of the kids on the wall. The calendars, he was literally every day marking off till he would go back for a year. And I just didn't get it. And, you know, when he moved, I still didn't get it. And it wasn't until kind of the realization that Rocky, you know, I had always wanted to do a documentary ever since I started in filmmaking and, you know, commercials and music videos. And I was reading Rocky's emails about, you know, which were sort of some of them were really inspiring and some of them were tragic. And knowing Rocky and sort of his background, and he was a character, and he was living an interesting life and doing interesting work. And it wasn't until I sort of made all those connections and remembering that I always kind of wanted to do a documentary that I took an interest in visiting him and seeing kind of what it was all about.
Well, that's really jumping into the fire with your first documentary then. How did you even approach filming a documentary in India when this is your first attempt?
Initially I was kind of having a reaction, or I was sort of rebelling from production. I, you know, spent time doing music videos and commercials, and everything was so planned out and polished, and I just wanted to react to it. I wanted to not be as planned out, I guess. I when I started, I was pretty careless, you know, to be honest with you. When Rocky first came, I was kind of lazy in the production. I didn't think through the shots. Sometimes I was just shooting by myself because I wasn't worried about the image. I was only interested in the content. So initially, it was kind of a reaction. I just wanted to enjoy. I wanted to work on something, and I wanted to enjoy it and not, you know, be stressed out by it. So that was kind of that was the mindset. But as I started moving forward, you know, other people started to take interest. I didn't have any budget to start off. I had access to different cameras because of my job. I worked for a production company in Pittsburgh called Animal. And, you know, I had access to gear and stuff like that, so just as I started moving forward, people took interest and started helping. And then, you know, I started taking it more seriously and thinking through, you know, the craft was important just as much as the content. So, you know, as the film progresses, in my mind, that, you know, the cinematography and everything, the craft gets better because of things like that, or because of that mindset.
Well, at one point during the documentary, you say that says you can't catch the experience on camera. And I'm wondering if at some point, you know, I'm sure it's awkward at first when you're filming and you think you're getting in people's way and they're not being as genuine as they could be because the camera's in their face all the time. So at what point did it transform into really capturing what was going on there?
I think it was just the feeling I had, you know, mixed with the experiences I was having, the feeling of just being there for the first time. Because when we got there, when we landed in India, it was, I think, 2 or 3 in the morning. And then we drove to the village in the dark, which was like an hour and a half drive. So I didn't even really, I was in India, but I couldn't see India. And then, you know, as the sun came up, the village was kind of like, and Rocky's world there was sort of like slowly revealed to me. And I guess just the mix of feelings and emotions, and it was so to me, it was so amazing and overwhelming. And I just felt like I was looking through the camera as well. I'm like, man, this is almost pathetic compared to what I'm feeling and what I'm experiencing. So that was sort of like keeping that in the film, to me, was a way of trying to communicate that idea that it's almost so much more than what I'm, than what I'm able to tell through the film. And, you know, at first it was difficult with the kids. They were just so excited to see the cameras and stuff like that. It was hard to get them to ignore the cameras at first. So that eventually they got more and more comfortable with it as we just, I mean, we were rolling kind of nonstop. So eventually they got more and more comfortable with it. By this point, Rocky was used to it because for 2 months I had been drilling him in the U.S. and just, you know, following him around and filming him. And so by that point, he had kind of gotten used to it. He was just excited introducing us and you know, me to the people he knew in the world the life he had been living there.
How good were you at being able to keep yourself separate as a filmmaker from what was going on in front of you? I mean, it's very compelling, so I can't imagine that you were just so, that you were easily able to stay objective.
Right. You know, the difficult thing is that the people, you know, the kids, Rocky, you know, kept, in a lot of ways, kept pulling you into things. I think it was kind of impossible at times to just be a fly on the wall. And I think that's why I ended up becoming more a part of the story than what I originally anticipated, because I did get pulled in a lot of ways. And I was, you know, really moved and impacted by everything that was happening. You know, I was inspired by Rocky, but I didn't want to force that on people. I wanted to show all sides of him. You know, in some ways, I was waiting for him to mess up. I was waiting, you know, where are the flaws? Where's this? Because I wanted those things to be in the film. I wanted people to, because I know Rocky isn't perfect, you know, and it's important for people to be able to relate to that and relate to that in his character. So I was just committed to trying to show all sides of him and all sides of India.
What are your thoughts on India now? I mean, there's still a connection there, obviously, between the orphanage and the film. And do you have any perceptions? Are you going to go back? Is this something you're going to participate in now, too, is going back to the orphanage?
Yeah, I've actually, I've been back. When the film was finished, my wife and I went to the hostel. We went to India. We spent 5 weeks there, and we shared the film. You know, we spent time with the kids, and then Rocky and I actually did a little bit of traveling to some places further south, a couple other orphanages that he knew about and had connections to through the one he was mostly helping at. And, I'm definitely really engaged to things that are going on. I'm not sure if you're aware of it or not, but all the proceeds from the film, all the filmmaker proceeds, you know, myself, the production company, you know, we're not going to see a dime from the film. We're donating all that we would make to Rocky and the kids and to other HIV/AIDS initiatives that we've partnered with along the way. So Rocky and I spent time just kind of, you know, finding ways that we can put that money to use. And so, you know, I'll be engaged in that process throughout the years. We started a nonprofit to basically receive these funds so that we can then make things happen.
You're going to be here for the screening, right? Are you going to be giving a presentation, anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be doing, as far as I know, we'll be introducing the film and doing a Q&A at the end of the screening, so.
Well, Steve Hoover, I really enjoyed watching the documentary. Thank you very much for coming on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Steve Hoover is the director of the documentary Blood Brother, which will be shown at the Milwaukee Film Festival on Thursday night at the Oriental Theater. Hoover spoke with Dan Harmon. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Great being with you today. I hope you can join tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.